Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello, folks. I am John Najarian for Compound Interests. I am the host of that show. And today I had the pleasure of speaking with J.R. Ron. He is the CEO of MindMed. It is a psychedelics company. And I know when a lot of you hear that, you're thinking to yourself, oh yeah, what a surprise. John's talking to a guy that's into psychedelics. I'm speaking to him, folks, because we all know mental illness is a huge problem around the world, and somewhere between 20 and 40 million Americans have either anxiety, addiction, or other that might make them a candidate for psychedelics. And this runs the gambit. These are not going to be something like a dispensary that you walk down to and you say, yeah, I think I'll microdose a little LSD right now. What MindMed is working on are therapies to treat anxiety, to treat ADHD, to treat Alzheimer's, to treat cluster headaches, and all manner of things, PTSD, folks. So open your mind up a little bit, because I think you want to see the first and thus far only publicly traded psychedelics company, because of the potential for that space, because of those, like I say, 40 million Americans with anxiety and another 20 million that have addictions. And that's just in America. Think of all the other folks around the world. So we're not talking small, we're talking big. And yet this is in the growth stage for this company. I think you're really going to enjoy the conversation with J.R. Ron of MindMed. First, if you don't mind, maybe give people a little bit of a background about your journey from Silicon Valley down right now, I guess, in Miami, and working with MindMed on the psychedelics.
Yeah, so I'm not typically based in Miami. We're usually based on Zoom, and I'm usually in Switzerland where a lot of our research is done. But due to COVID, I'm stuck here, and I don't know if that's a good thing right now. But it was a couple months ago when everybody was shivering up north. But I started out in Silicon Valley. I was an earlier employee at Uber. I then left and went through something called the Y Combinator program, which is where companies like Airbnb and Dropbox came out of. And I was looking around at all my friends and going, what is everybody going to do for work in 10 years time? We're basically automating everybody out of a job, for anyone from an accountant to somebody that makes coffee. And that led me to believe, well, mental health and addiction are going to become very, very big problems, because when people lose their purpose to wake up every morning, these illnesses are, become more prevalent in societies. So that was really sort of the kickoff of how I transitioned from the tech space into the mental health space. And I was, back when I was at Y Combinator, was reading this report, I think it was done by McKinsey, that said by 2030, 800 million people were going to lose their jobs due to AI and automation. Okay, that's a lot of people. That's a global number, but if you just think about in the last, 3 or 4 months, based on COVID, 40 million plus Americans have lost their job. So the issues that I was thinking were going to be, 10 years away in terms of having this great depression of mental health and addiction, just got fast forwarded. And so what we are doing as a company, and why I set up MindMed, was to really focus on how can we find innovative ways to solve mental health and addiction. And I happened upon psychedelics and as part of that, finding what we thought was a solution, or what is a potential solution for some very, very big problems in the United States and around the world.
Well, and JR, I mean, from what I've been reading, it seems that ADHD and other addictions and things like that, I know ADHD is, I'm pretty aware of it because I've got it.
I think most smart and intelligent people have ADHD. It's a common trend, but
I wish that was the reason. I hope it is. But my daughter has it. In fact, both my daughters do. My second daughter is adopted, so at least it didn't transfer from me to her. It's just something that affects an awful lot of people. Dealing with it, there are a host of treatments for ADHD, and there are treatments, some of which can lead to addictions as well. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, I haven't had to be on medication, although my wife frequently thinks that I should be. I've managed to deal with it, and like you say, whether it's Steven Jobs with some of the ways that he operated, or some of the ways that I operate, perhaps you as well. I mean, do you have a direct relationship with anything like ADHD or anything in this realm?
Yeah, definitely. I actually, I struggled with mental health and addiction for a lot of my adult life. And I think it's a tough thing to say. I think a lot of Americans struggle to sort of admit that at times, because there's a stigma in society that you don't really want to talk about that in public. I think that's starting to change. When I was 13 years old, my parents brought me to a psychiatrist, and they sent me home with a bottle of Ritalin. The bottle of Ritalin turned into a bottle of Concerta, which turned into a bottle of Xanax. And got to the point where, I was even abusing these medicines that were legal, FDA approved, and much of my generation was put on. I mean, I think they even call us Generation Adderall now, because of the sort of overprescription of ADHD medicines, these stimulant-based medicines, which are not great things to put in your body. In Silicon Valley, there's sort of been a trend amongst folks my age, and a lot of the tech workers out there at some of the large tech companies, to microdose psychedelics, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not actually taking a hallucinogenic experience, but taking a small finite amount to help them better focus at work or achieve a certain flow state, just having a better sense of attention. So traditionally that's been done with microdosing of LSD. And when I say those three letters, a lot of people look at me, not only is the guy bald, he also has horns on his head. So, but we're seeing great anecdotal evidence that microdosing LSD might have the potential to treat ADHD, particularly adult ADHD. And I think my generation wants to get off of these stimulant-based medicines that they've been on for so many years. They come with all sorts of, side effects, like you can't sleep. There's, a whole bunch of other things that are not great about those medicines. Behind me, I don't know if you can see it, but that is Albert Hofmann in a light painting. And Albert Hofmann is the inventor of LSD. He actually discovered it in Basel, Switzerland, which is the home of Novartis, a very large pharmaceutical company. And LSD was invented there. Really, it was developed as a medicine. It wasn't until sort of the 1960s we started seeing sort of people rejecting the use of psychedelics and governments really criminalizing them. So, long story short, yes, we are working on treatments for ADHD, and we think it's a big component of the work that we're doing in the psychedelics arena.
Well, and I applaud you for that. I think when places like Johns Hopkins University, I didn't tell you, JR, but my dad's a doctor. Oh. So that's my nickname is Dr. J. I have no doctorate and didn't go to med school or anything. I just took it because it was an easy moniker down on the trading floor when somebody was wondering, hey, who'd I make that trade with? Dr. J. Oh, okay. Yeah. Check. We did it. So my dad had actually studied it as well. LSD and effects of LSD. He's a kidney transplant doctor, though, so that wasn't his main focus whatsoever. But because of when he was coming out of med school, which would have been probably about 1955, like you say, that was more or less the time some of that stuff was in the more scientific realm before the Timothy Learys and everybody else kind of hijacked it into the into pop culture and so forth. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and all that sort
still
of stuff.
Still a good song, though.
Still a good song, yeah. But, well, you know, how do you view the current mental health landscape, you know, with COVID? Because we're both, at least at this time, folks, here we are, the 8th of July, we're talking about trying to come out of this thing. And a lot of people have had mental health issues because of being cooped up. Some of that may be manifest itself, JR, with some of the ways the riots got violent, because people had just been trapped in their homes for so long that certainly there was an outrage about what happened to George Floyd and others, but there was also just a lot of anger about, I haven't seen any of my friends. I want to get out. I want to go do something. And some of those folks are going to have not just anxiety disorder, but they're going to have real issues, mental health issues. Sure. Do you think COVID is really going to be a trigger for, you know, perhaps for some of that?
Well, I think it already is. I think when it comes to mental health and addiction, though, it's these are long-term effects. These are not sort of short-term illnesses or diseases. They, you know, they'll manifest themselves over the next 10 to 15 years. And so, but let's just look at the short term, right? From February 15th to March 15th, 75% of Xanax prescriptions were new Xanax prescriptions, right? So I was in the Walgreens around the corner from my house filling a prescription, and a woman was asking the pharmacist, and she was going, you know, my doctor told me I'm getting very anxious while watching the news, and, you know, so he gave me this Xanax. Tell me about this. What is it? And so, you know, that's not going to solve the problem. Xanax, if you've ever taken it, it's a pretty intense medication, and it's actually found a lot of times in overdose deaths in opioid patients. Xanax and opioids are combined in about a third of those deaths. So, yeah, it's not the solution to anxiety, and we have observed that. There's 40 million Americans that have anxiety. This is, you know, a serious issue. And if you look at, you were talking about George Floyd. If you look at the African American population, anxiety is at its highest level that it's been in recent history. It's at 41% of African Americans have some form of anxiety at the moment. That was based off a study I think I saw in the Washington Post. So we got some big problems to solve. Specifically around anxiety, and these are very large markets, right? These are markets that haven't necessarily been addressed by the larger pharmaceutical companies of recent. There hasn't been much innovation in the mental health and addiction space. And so that's the opportunity that we see as a company. We want to completely change the paradigm on how mental health is treated. And so the typical treatment is put a patient on a pill a day for the rest of their lives, and because that seems like an annuity and a great business.
Sorry about that.
No, he or she is speaking up too. I mean, these are big problems. So, but yeah, I mean, so what we're doing is looking to now start a phase 2B trial with the FDA based on what we call experiential LSD. So actually having a hallucinogenic experience to get after some of the underlying causes of what is causing the anxiety. And that's a completely different way at looking at anxiety and mental health. And so we're basing this off of a phase two study that we're already doing in Switzerland. And we purchased it, the rights to it previously. I'm from the University Hospital Basel, back where That guy discovered LSD, so we sort of went home and got a hold of a trial that's been going on since 2017. And so we have an exclusive relationship with the University Hospital Basel to work on psychedelic therapies. And so it's a completely new asset class, a completely new space. But the problems that we're solving are huge. I mean, these are 40 million Americans with anxiety, 20 plus million with depression, addiction, 17 million with depression. These are, these numbers will get bigger after COVID for sure.
Right. Absolutely. And think of those numbers too, folks. When you're talking about, 20 million, this is not like an orphan drug treatment. This is like mainstream. This is what JR is doing over with MindMed is going to be something that you're going to be hearing a lot about, because people need this kind of treatment either as a way to take the anxiety levels down, and or like you've already mentioned, addictions, perhaps PTSD and some of these other things. I mean, is Project Lucy, is that the one that you're talking about overseas?
Yeah, that's right. So Project Lucy is our LSD program for anxiety. It is based off a phase 2 trial that is happening overseas in Switzerland. But we're going to be bringing that back to the United States and opening up a new drug trial with the FDA, a later stage. We're applying to open that drug trial sometime soon. And we want to make this an approved therapy in the United States. And so we want it accessible to those that are in need. What's kind of interesting is, and what Project Lucy really sort of is looking at as well, is the interconnectedness of mental health. A lot of times folks that have anxiety also have depression. And, for example, ADHD sufferers, 50% of them have anxiety, right? There's clear correlations. Why aren't we looking at the interconnectedness of mental health? And so we think that psychedelic assisted therapies might offer the greatest hope to actually look at that interconnectedness and really change how we go about treating this. And I think change the relationship people have with seeking help. It's a tough stigma to overcome, the history of psychedelics, but I think we need to focus more on the outcomes. And if we do that, we're going to have a really big business. It's a whole new sector in the pharmaceutical market that's really largely untapped, because the larger pharma companies have never really done the research because of the stigma associated with the names on these substances. The most recent thing that sort of has become an approved FDA medicine is esketamine, which is based on the psychedelic ketamine. So that's by Johnson & Johnson, or Janssen Pharmaceuticals, which is part of J&J. Big Pharma, though, has this search and acquire model where they look at smaller companies like ours. When we get later and later stage with our drug trials, a lot of times they make acquisitions. And so I think we're in a great position as a company and the first publicly listed psychedelics company out there to form some great partnerships going forward with larger pharmaceutical companies.
Since JR mentioned it, folks, I'll hit it up real quick. The symbol, because MindMed is publicly traded, is MMED or MMEDF. And one of those is on the NEO exchange, I think.
Yeah, and one NEO in Canada, and MMEDF is down in the US.
Yep, on the OTC.
Yep.
And 65 million-ish market cap, does that sound about right? I looked a couple days ago.
Yeah, I think we're pushing a little higher, but honest with you, as a CEO, you focus on the business and less on the share price, but I would say it's around there, yeah.
And their go public with this one, folks, was brought out with a friend of mine, Kevin O'Leary, obviously a friend of JR's as well now. And he has spoken about MindMed glowingly. I mean, he is really a true believer in what you guys are doing, JR, because as soon as he considered investing in it, he and I were talking and he said, John, you got to take a look at psychedelics. And I thought he wanted to go out to dinner. But he was very serious and he thinks this is serious medicine. So even though I have a laugh there, I'm deadly serious about the things that JR is doing with this company, folks. Tom Shoes, founder, is in as one of the investors. They've got a lot of folks that are very involved that have been involved in the cannabis space, as you might imagine, because a lot of folks that recognize the medicinal qualities of marijuana or cannabis are also looking at this and saying, wow, look at the size of this market. One of the things maybe, JR, that you could hit on is how do you plan to use MDMA, you know, which is another, you know, just like LSD, you guys also have like the purer version of ecstasy, MDMA, out there, and you guys are examining exactly how that could fit into this portfolio, right?
Yeah, so we also acquired about 9 clinical trials that had been looking at the human safety of MDMA. Actually, how does that work in one's body? You know, a lot of these substances are not super well understood. And so as a company, our mission is to make them understood. We are trying to prove that they're safe and effective medicines for mental health. So we acquired some data and these clinical trials from the University Hospital Basel overseas in Switzerland. But what we're looking at is how can we combine MDMA with another psychedelic, maybe like LSD, to produce the best therapeutic experience for a patient. You know, so these medicines are not, you just, you know, take a pill home and that's it. You know, these are, you go in for a therapy session where someone sits you down and you take these substances, and they really act as catalysts to explore what's actually going on inside your consciousness. And really dealing with things that are troubling you and might be causing you to constantly drink, right? Or, you know, constantly having you worrying because of a past trauma or event. And so in order to do that, we are also doing a lot of R&D to figure out what is the best dosing technology that we can give to therapists and patients. Because all this is gonna happen in a medical and clinical setting. You're not going to go down to your local dispensary and pick up a bunch of mushrooms or LSD or MDMA. That's not, in our opinion, not happening. These are going to be, you know, FDA approved medicines if they can prove that they are effective. And the science is pointing towards that. But you're going to most likely go into a clinic or a hospital in the direct supervision of a medical professional to use them. So very, I think, different than you sort of alluded to some early cannabis backers. Bruce Linton is the founder of Canopy Growth. He's also a board member here. You know, this is different than cannabis. Cannabis really took off due to a recreational, I think, approach. I mean, there were some early medicinal companies, and actually the medicinal companies have held up pretty well. I mean, if you look at GW and some of the other ones. But what is interesting about a potential FDA approvals is you have a defendable business model where you can protect IP and you can sell these therapies through the existing medical infrastructure that is in America. And that's a very, very big market. So we're gonna solely focus on bringing all of these substances and medicines and getting them approved as medicines through the FDA.
Now, you know, going back to your Y Combinator and Silicon Valley experience, You can hardly speak to somebody in Silicon Valley. I grew up in the Bay Area, by the way, okay. JR.
Got it.
So I know a lot of folks in the Valley, obviously not as many as you, because I've been living in Chicago for the last 38 years. But I hear a lot still about folks microdosing various drugs in terms of how it helps their productivity out mm-hmm. there. I mean, I hear a lot about microdosing LSD and so forth. Mm-hmm. And you guys, I know you're not talking about, just as you said accurately, at least your vision right now isn't that I'll walk into a dispensary here in Chicago and pick up some microdose LSD and just go home and have fun. It'll be in a therapy, at least, again, your vision right now. Right. But you guys are doing a lot with the microdosing side of that business, right?
Yeah, we are. We are looking at microdosing, maybe in a way to potentially complement some of our hallucinogenic or experiential therapies that would happen in a clinic, but also, can there be a take-home medicine? Is there a take-home medicine model here of why somebody could microdose? And so we are looking at both of those options, and I think we're one of the few companies in our space that takes an approach to both. But we do see a huge potential for microdosing. We're actually doing the first phase two study ever of microdosing of LSD for adult ADHD. That's happening in the Netherlands and also in Switzerland. I will be kicking that study off by the end of the year. That is what we envision to be a take-home medicine. We're going to have to develop technologies that allow for it to be taken home and so that it's not abused. But we think we have a pretty good handle on how we can achieve that. Microdosing is very prevalent in Silicon Valley. You'd be surprised at some of the folks that are microdosing. There's some, you know, people that are in the Wall Street Journal every day. It's definitely something that is a growing trend in America.
Let me run a couple others by you because I, even though I've been exploring MindMed, and I think it looks like a fabulous endeavor you guys have got going. Mescaline, peyote, mushrooms. I mean, my wife, for instance, JR, is a mushroom hunter. She loves going out, not to eat or not to ingest for a psychedelic, but she just, you know, like some people are bird watchers. I don't know how it happened, but my wife is a mushroom hunter.
They're beautiful. You know, my ex-wife was a mushroom hunter, so I know the type. There's a lot of different psychedelic substances. We've been talking a lot about LSD, but there are, you know, psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms. There are mescaline, yes, which is derived from peyote. MDMA is also psychedelic. We're looking at the continuum of these substances. And right now we have really like four programs that are seeking, you know, commercial drug development. We have a program for anxiety, which we talked about. We have a program for ADHD, which we talked about. We have a program for addiction that is based on a substance that's based on ibogaine or iboga. It comes from a root in West Africa, which has been shown to anecdotally treat opioid addicts very well. And we created a non-hallucinogenic form of ibogaine called 18-MC. It's really kind of like a microdose form. We envision it might be a take-home medicine. And that's really trying to be the antibiotic of addiction, right? We don't want to put people on a pill a day for the rest of their lives. We actually want to solve underlying addiction. And what's interesting about addiction is the mechanism of action looks like it's craving something called dopamine, which is that pleasure center of your brain. It's that when you take your first, you know, swig of wine right now in isolation, you sort of get that little bit of a buzz. That is a dopamine rush, and that is what keeps you coming back for more. And so what this particular medicine that we're working on is it helps regulate that dopamine. And so this is a, you know, addiction, and we're looking particularly at the opioid crisis. The opioid crisis costs the country $500 billion a year, right? Opioid deaths are up in the midst of COVID-19, right? This was a big crisis before COVID, and we think after it's going to be even worse because a lot of people are not getting the treatments that they need. And there really hasn't been any innovation in that space for a number of years. Methadone is just a little bit less harmful of a narcotic. It's not going to solve the opioid crisis. And, you know, I've had numerous friends, you know, have problems with opioids. I myself, also have struggled with addiction for much of my adult life. And that's really what this company is about. It's about a mission. It's very mission driven. We want to solve these issues for everyday Americans.
Well, you guys have phase two trials going on for cluster headaches.
Yeah.
And if you could give us any update at all about that, I'm sure any of the folks that are trading your stock would love to hear. So I guess you have to be somewhat careful, but
yeah.
Do you have any public information you can tell us about how phase two is going with that?
I do. Yeah. So the phase two trial kicked off. And we've begun treating patients with LSD. Cluster headaches are actually called suicide headaches. And they are, from what I've gathered from multiple patients in this space, they are one of the most painful illnesses out there. I had one person describe it to me as more painful than childbirth. So this is, you know, it doesn't affect a lot of people, but it affects enough, and people have been self-treating themselves with LSD, and they've had to get it in a legal manners, in order. It's the only thing that is really solving these cluster headaches. And there's actually a community, online that, you know, talks about it. And so what we decided was, well, look, let's actually make this into a potentially FDA-approved medicine. And so let's conduct the clinical trials to prove that it actually does work and it's not just based on anecdote. And so we're going to be collecting the data and hopefully finding a solution for folks that have these suicide headaches. And I think it's just, that is what we need to look at. We got to look at the outcomes. Because if you can solve problems for patients that aren't being solved, you're going to have an ultimately big business, and nobody's going to care about what substance your medicine's based off of, as long as you're solving the problem and presenting the data in a legal manner. And so everything we do is in a federally legal manner. You know, Kevin, I think he's pretty gung-ho about MindMed and psychedelics. He wasn't so much when we first started talking about MindMed. He actually turned me down on my first pitch. And said, get lost, you know, my name is not Timothy Leary, it's Kevin O'Leary, and, you know, you need to, yeah, I'd never invested in cannabis, so I, you know, why should I invest in psychedelics? And what we proved to him was, look, everything we do is federally regulated, and this is all going to happen through the FDA pathway. And that's, I think, a key difference with some of the other cannabis companies that are out there that might not all, not everything is federally legal.
Now, you mentioned the United States and our FDA, and it's medicines or something like that in the EU. I forget what theirs European, is called, but obviously you'd go after that market as well, right?
Sure.
I mean, just because you're based in Basel, Switzerland, doesn't mean that you guys wouldn't be making this available anywhere where an agency would approve it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, typically you look at both of those markets when you're developing a drug. The U.S. drug market is always a bigger market. And so it's sought after by pharmaceutical companies like ours. But yeah, we'd be looking at both the U.S. and Europe. These are global problems, right? They need global solutions.
Now, JR, when you're sitting with a guy like Kevin, that's one thing. And when you're sitting as the CEO with, you know, somebody from a larger fund, not that Kevin isn't large, he is, But, you know, if it was a fund or somebody that said, well, you know, under ESG, we're not sure if we can. And then you, of course, are pointing out, look, we're not recreational. You know, this isn't like going out and, you know, I have nothing against tequila or vodka or any of that stuff. But, you know, if somebody wanted to say it from an ESG standpoint, well, you know, cigarettes, tobacco, liquor, you know, some of these things, guns, I don't want to be investing in those areas.
Sure.
I get it. But how about when you're talking to some of the large investors that you must occasionally speak to about, you know, psychedelics? Do you get a lot of pushback, or as soon as they hear the medical application side of it, they do like Kevin did and they soften up a little bit and they start to embrace the idea?
Well, there's always that sort of initial stigma, you know, put the blinders on. I don't want to hear about this for like the first minute or two. And then you go, wait a minute, let's talk about numbers. 40 million Americans, that's a huge market. And this is all federally legal. And suddenly they become much more interested, and the stigma from the 1960s sort of just evaporates in the air. With Kevin, it took another phone call, but there are some pretty large institutions that have invested into MindMed before we went public, and our existing shareholders now. You know, I can say that some large academic institutions are shareholders by default of the funds that, you know, have invested in this company. And so we thought that was going to be an issue, right? That was sort of the initial reason we listed in Canada first. But what I realized shortly thereafter was, you know, this is going to be a whole brand new big space. It's a new asset class, and institutional investors want to get involved and get in on that action. You know, this is, some very large companies are going to be made. And we are the only publicly listed psychedelic pharmaceutical company out there in later stage development. There's really kind of three leaders in the space. There's ourselves, a company that is backed by, there are two other companies that are backed by Peter Thiel, called Atai, and also Compass Pathways. And those are two private companies, but we're all taking this FDA approach. And, you know, I think we're going to continue to attract institutional capital because of that approach. And so, you know, I did a update call to our shareholders last week, just sort of keeping them apprised of what we're working on. And one of them asked me, you know, will you ever buy a recreational psychedelics company and sort of, you know, have two arms to the company? And, you know, I think that'd be really tough. I don't think I could go in front of the FDA and the DEA and all the sort of agencies that we have to work with without staying in our medical approach. And I think that is the long-term strategy that is ultimately going to win in the psychedelic-inspired medicine space.
All right. I'm sure some of the, again, investor types that are watching are going to want to know, okay, what kind of scale can I get out of this? In other words, can you scale like some of these biotechs? Can you scale like even some of the, obviously our focus this year, JR, unfortunately, has been COVID. And who exactly can scale with tests? Who can scale with a vaccine, potentially, if it's approved? Who can scale with testing, you know, whether it's a 15-minute test or, you know, whether it's a nasal swab, whatever it is. So can you guys, in the space that you're in, scale like a biotech?
Yeah, I think we are. I think we can, and we will. You know, one of the things to keep in mind is that, yeah, there is a there's a virus out there. It's terrible. It's killing people. You know, we're going to have to continue to test for it. We don't know when the vaccine is going to come through. That hopefully is soon. But what I think is going to be the single biggest impact, like right now we're looking at the acute issues that have to do with COVID, people dying in hospitals, you know, not enough respirators, you know, that's a problem. And if you turn on the news, it looks like an even bigger problem. But what is ultimately going to have the single biggest impact on our society is that we've been in isolation for the last 4 or 5 months, right? Addiction and mental health skyrocket out of control when you're isolated. If you, there's plenty of models on this. I mean, just there's some one animal model called the rat park models, where they took two sets of rats. They put one set totally in isolation by themselves, and they put another and sort of that was able to interact in sort of like this little mini city. And they tested how much addictive substances each group had. The ones that were in isolation were 19 times the amount of consumption of addictive substances. Okay, so that rat park model is happening at a global scale right now. And so mental health and addiction markets are going to scale. And companies like ours that have innovative approaches and companies, you know, that are really trying to solve these problems are going to have to scale with that problem. And so this is not like an orphan drug market where you have like, you know, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 people where you might charge a lot for that medicine for a small finite amount of people. There's 40 million Americans with anxiety. There's, you know, 20 plus million with addiction. Big markets.
Yep.
We have to figure out a way to scale with those markets. I don't think that is scaling is the issue here. I think it's actually addressing the whole market. Can you address the whole market? So,
okay. How about doctors and insurance companies?
Great question.
You and I both know that, yeah, you know, for you to get that prescription, since you're talking more or less about therapies, you're talking about, you know, doctors embracing this and saying, wow, I am seeing, I read the papers on what JR and his firm have done. I'm a believer and now I'm starting to prescribe it. Are you getting a lot of pushback, just like I asked you about investors? Are you getting pushback from doctors about that and or the insurance companies, if you wouldn't mind hitting those two questions?
Well, I think you and Kevin would probably call it, you know, Kevin O'Leary would probably call it the power of the purse, right? So, you know, who's going to pay for this stuff? And, you know, it's not necessarily always the patients that make those decisions. That's a little messed up in its own right. But yeah, the insurers are going to have to get on board. And the only way that insurers get on board is if you present them the data and you have an FDA approval to show, hey, this is a medicine. Here's the data. This actually helps cure anxiety or treat anxiety and, you know, and has a much better effect than this medicine. And so that's what we have to do. We're in that data gathering phase right now to make this presentable to governments and also societies and also insurers or the payers. And I think insurance companies would much rather find solutions that actually solve problems than putting people on a pill a day for the rest of their lives that they have to pay for every single day. And so I think our model is going to be very much in demand. And because of that, because of the value we're providing to society, I think we'll be rewarded in a financial manner as well. We'll have to find the right model with those payers as we get closer to commercialization. But it is, you know, in the US, it's something that every pharmaceutical company has to deal with. How do you best price your drug that you're putting on the market? Fortunately, these are very big markets. So it's, you don't necessarily have to price it like you would in orphan drug, which sometimes gets some those companies into some trouble.
Right. Well, as far as burn rate, I'm sure something that you're terribly familiar with, because any of the biotech companies, I'm not saying you're biotech, but any of the biotech pharmaceutical companies always have to deal with that, because all of the meetings that guys like JR have to do, folks, all of the papers that have to be submitted, all of the data that's got to be, you know, triple checked and, you know, every I has to be dotted, T's crossed, all of that stuff. That doesn't even go into the scientific side of it. Now, I applaud you guys for getting into the, you know, working with that university in Basel, because that's going to be huge, obviously.
Yeah, for sure.
But, as far as burn rate, you guys have enough cash to get this thing to market?
Yeah, we just, we've raised a total of about $40 million since inception. We are very well budgeted for around the next year to 18 months. And, I think, yes, do biotech companies burn money? Yep. But also they have potential binary outcomes for, if a drug does get approved, you have very, very high upside if that works out. What we're going to be looking at is how do we build the largest portfolio and pipeline in the psychedelic space? And can we partner some of those programs off with larger pharmaceutical companies who have large balance sheets that are going to help get some of these projects over the line? And I think that's a prudent way to do this. And it sort of sets you up to, to have a potential acquisition of your company down the line, but also you know that you'll have the balance sheet to go to market. And so my co-founder, Steve Hurst, has been in the pharma space for 40 years. He's structured a lot of these type of transactions to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in R&D reimbursements that come into a company. And so there is the potential that we can strike those type of deals at MindMed and not necessarily just have to constantly go back to the market and raise money like some folks do. We actually want to have a more sustainable approach to the development and R&D that we're doing.
So last question then, if I could, JR, how do you see MindMed evolving over the next 1 and 2 years? I mean, when I looked at it, when I read all the data that I could find on you guys, seemed like you'd made a lot of great partnerships already, you've got real institutions that are experimenting, I'll call it experimenting, testing, whatever, like Johns Hopkins, with psychedelics to see what sort of results that they're getting. The more of that obviously can come your way, the better.
Sure.
But how do you see MindMed progressing over this next year and 2 years?
Well, we're just going to focus on the clinical trials and collecting the data and advancing those trials farther and farther along the value chain and hopefully closer to an approval of those medicines. And so I think within 1 to 2 years, we should have, be in a later stage phase 2 trial, should be well underway or finding some great data out. And ideally, if we're talking sort of the 1 to 2 year horizon, we hopefully should have a phase 3 trial going on at some point in one of our programs. And that is when, sort of later stage phase 2, early stage phase 3, that's when you get those partnerships for pharma coming in and providing even more capital to your company. I think because we're the first publicly listed psychedelics company, we have the vast potential to also roll up a lot of the space and be the single biggest psychedelics company out there if we play our cards right. And I think that's important. Early mover advantage is huge, especially in a fast-growing, fast-paced space like this. So Kevin, we do a sort of call every 2 weeks, and Kevin O'Leary says to me, he's like, you got to focus and look at how do you build the largest company that has the biggest pipeline, because that is what other companies are going to be interested in. And so that's our goal.
JR, it's a pleasure. I really appreciate your time today, sir.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it.
Folks, I've been speaking with JR Rahn, CEO of MindMed, and again, MMED and MMEDF are the symbols, either for the over-the-counter or on the NEO exchange up in Canada. JR, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.